And Jay, thank you for including me. Oh, sorry.
Happy to. Good afternoon. My name is Jay Rahman, and I am professor of urology at Penn State Health and chair of the AUA's Office of Education. It's my pleasure to host another episode in our educational podcast series, with this specific show being one that focuses on our core curriculum topics. This show is titled BPH, Surgical Treatment, and it's really my pleasure to host Dr. Bilal Chugdai, who is Chief of Urology at the Plainview Hospital within the Northwell system. Dr. Chugdai is board certified by the American Board of Urology, as well as the Urogynecology and Pelvic Reconstructive Surgery Group. Bilal, first of all, delighted to have you join us. Really appreciate you taking some time out of the busy day to do a podcast.
Well, thanks for including me, and I'm happy to join.
So, you know, the thrust of this podcast is really looking at and talking about some of the key elements that we cover within the core curriculum, specifically in the realm of BPH and surgical management of BPH. But I think before we sort of dive right into surgical management, you know, I think you would agree, as somebody who manages this disease, I think starting with the 20,000 foot view and then maybe finishing off at some of the surgical modalities makes a lot of sense. So let's talk first about, you know, maybe bladder health and, you know, what patients will be coming in sort of as they're presenting symptom complaint, that sort of clues you into this whole realm of, hey, you know, BPH and maybe down the road, BPH-based therapy.
Yeah, no, so Jay, I think that's a great starting point. And I think the first thing I would bring up is the fact that I think all urologists, if you see any male patients, you're going to be seeing some BPH. And when it comes to male lower urinary tract symptoms, you kind of have to have a talk track and some plan, irrespective of specialty, right? So when we get into it, you know, like as you see the aging male, you want to have that conversation, obviously having the, you know, history, physical exam. I mean, for, I think across a lot of practices, using patient reported outcomes, commonly like the IPSS, is a great starting point of assessing what patients may, you know, may have lower urinary tract symptoms, either from a screening standpoint or from the standpoint of if you're going to be treating it as well. I think there is a new thinking in terms of the fact that when you take a look at the bladder, right, made of smooth muscle, very similar to the idea of the heart, right, that, you know, there's data that suggests earlier intervention may lead to better outcomes as well. So I think having that conversation with the patient, being like, look, you've got intermittent stream, you've got some post-void dribble, you've got some other issues that, you know, maybe pointed to something bigger, right? And at least it starts the conversation of, you know, this quality of life condition.
So maybe just, you sort of said it so nicely, but as you sort of look at this concept of maybe bladder health, can you give the listeners a little bit of a sense of this patient that comes to your office with maybe these initial complaints that of lower urinary tract symptoms, male patient lower urinary tract symptoms, what sort of, beyond sort of the standard history and physical examination, what sort of testing do you like to do? I mean, do you get some type of symptom score? Do you obtain a flow rate in everybody? Do you obtain a post-void residual? What? And I realize that there might be differences from person to person, but maybe what's your practice pattern of how you kind of get a lay of the land getting started?
Yeah, so I try to be, try to follow guidelines to the best of my ability. I think for some patients, they come in and, you know, they've already either seen a urologist, they've already have a bit of a workup, they've already visited Dr. Google, so they kind of have an idea of what they want, right? But I would say when patients first come in, I usually take that first visit and go, we're going to rule out all the big bad things, right? We're going to make sure there's no urinary tract infection. We're going to make sure there's no hematuria, right? All patients will fill out an IPSS. And I tell patients, like, although it's annoying to fill out the same form, this form gives me a bit of a barometer of where we are, where you're going, and where our hope to end up is, right? At that point, I'll have a conversation with patients in terms of, like, what the journey is going to be like. In other words, you know, there's a different options. And remember, it's not a, it's more like a forks in the road. In other words, you don't necessarily have to go and fail medications and fail whatever, but you need to be aware of all the options as you move forward. Initially, I do get a post-void residual on all patients just to make sure that I'm not missing something obvious, like, you know, retention with like, you know, PVR 500, something, you know, something insane. But at that point, assuming we're not, this is like your index patient. In other words, like, you know, routine, let's call it 55-year-old, got some lower urinary tract symptoms, IPSS, let's call it like, you know, 15 over three, something along those lines. I'll offer, you know, behavioral changes. I'll tell them about the role of potentially even supplements, because a lot of patients want to know about it. And I tell them that, you know, I've got a talk track on that in terms of like what defines high quality supplements. And in addition to, we don't have great data on supplements at the moment, right? So it's something that you can try, but it's hard for us as physicians to guide you there because we don't have high quality data in that sector. When it comes to medications, tell them the traditional, you know, alpha blockers, 5-ARIs, role of PDE5 inhibitors. And I also mentioned that, you know, when it comes to interventional therapy, there's the minimally invasive therapies. There's the surgical therapies, like cavitating surgery. And then there's also new clinical trials, right? And I lay that out for patients. And sometimes they'll gravitate from one thing to another. So you'll see some patients that go, I love pills, add one more on, right? Mm-hmm. You'll have other patients who are kind of like, please, no more pills, let's solve the issue. And you have some patients who are like, look, I want to get into something that's really new, novel, I'm very interested in a clinical trial.
And then maybe just to sort of touch on medications. And I feel like one of the things we're learning a little bit more as time has gone on is that medications for BPH and medications maybe for the bladder attributable to urinary tract symptoms are not mundane, and they may in some cases have associated side effects. And I don't do as much in this realm, but folks that are on these medications, it's always interesting how many of them are somewhat surprised that if they start on this, it's sort of a lifelong type medication, right? It's not you take it for 3 months or 6 months and then you're done taking it. Do you have a general algorithm when you're thinking about 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, how you sort of assess for prostate size? Is this just sort of a DRE, prostate feels big, or do you get some sort of more formalized measurement? And in your practice, does that matter? I mean, I think there's some stuff with prostate size and the 5-ARIs. Just talk about that medication class, if you don't mind.
So when we... even alpha blockers, right? Alpha blockers aren't benign on their own. Like a lot of older men, they get lightheaded, they get dizzy. You add on an alpha blocker, all of a sudden you turn from, you know, sort of being dizzy into a fall. Mm-hmm. So I try to caution patients in terms of like what are common side effects. And, you know, I also mentioned that there's some early data that looks at the role, you know, potentially congestive heart failure for alpha blockers, potentially even, you know, risks of dementia with alpha blockers. And, you know, obviously the data is mixed. It's not high quality studies, but it's out there. And some patients will come to me with that being like, are you really going to give me a med that can cause congestive heart failure? I'm like, no. But at the same time, you know, I want to make sure that, you know, I share that data with them. 5-ARIs, I agree, are far more complex, because the thing with 5-ARIs is that although it's a medication that, you know, for some older men seems like it's perfectly safe, but some of the side effects never really go away. Like if you end up getting breast enlargement, nipple tenderness. In addition to that, a lot of men will complain that, you know, their ejaculatory volume never got back to where it was before, or even their libido has never gotten back to where it was before. So I try to caution them in terms of like what 5-ARIs can offer. And I do tell them that it's really designed for bigger prostates. There are surrogates that I can use. So I tell them like, look, if I have a PSA that's greater than 1.4, I'm pretty sure your PSA is going, I mean, your prostate's going to be greater than 40 grams, right? At the same time, you know, the best way of assessing prostate size is a transrectal ultrasound. Some patients are like, look, I think knowing the size is going to be helpful, because if I have a really big prostate, maybe I don't even want to do medicines. Maybe I want to move on to something else. Mm-hmm. Other patients, they'll say, you know what? I really want to exhaust every pill possible before we try anything else. Mm-hmm. So I try to have that conversation. In addition to that, we know with 5-ARIs, they can have effect on mood. And there's also the potential risk of post-finasteride syndrome, although atypical, uncommon, usually happens in younger males. But still, it's one of those things where I try to tell patients that when you are taking a pill, right, its effects are going to affect your whole body. Some of the effects, and most of the effects, are reversible. A few of the effects may not be reversible, but you want to know that up front.
So, you know, one of the things that's always hard, let's just say we talk about a post-void residual in the office, or you talk about maybe a flow rate. you know, office-based studies are often a snapshot in time, right? If somebody comes into the office, you're getting a single measurement, and then trying to make decision-making based on that objective criteria, but at that moment in time. And I think as technology's improved, as we have a lot more of these sort of smart, quote-unquote, devices, I think more and more patients are coming in with the ability to have some type of home-based apps, home-based devices, which may more accurately reflect analogous to a home blood pressure machine where things are chronically, not just the day you walk into the office there. Talk a little bit about that. And you know, do you find that concept to be useful? Do your patients use that? And you know, where do you see that going?
So right now, there are a handful of like audio-based app and home-based assessments that can be done. I think it's a fascinating area because ultimately with the combination of, you know, the flows that you get. And remember, when we talk about flows, like I think sometimes we, sometimes when we look at flows, we look at things like just QMAX, right? But there's a lot more information there. There's like the voided volume, right? There's the pattern that's given. And in some ways, these patterns that's there, and I think a lot of these home-based apps are working really hard to figure out, like, for example, who might be responders to meds? Who might be responders to procedures? Who actually is underlying detrusor overactivity, underactivity? Because if you've got a bunch of small voids in there, maybe we're dealing with more of an overactive bladder phenomenon, which, you know, again, occurs in about 30% of men. So I think the home-based apps are actually fascinating. I think it's a great way to incorporate into practice. I'm currently working on how to best incorporate into practice because for some patients, you know, like not, you know, like some people bring their phone into the bathroom all the time. Mm-hmm. Some patients, not so much. Some people find that kind of gross being like, why am I bringing my phone in? Where am I going to put it down? So there's aspects to it, but I do think that this home-based assessment, because we know that when you look at, the office-based Euroflow, the non-diagnostic rate is really high, probably around like 35-40%. Lots of patients don't have 150 cc's in there. Everyone pees right before they see the urologist, right before they have to give a specimen. So it's I do think that having that ability to assess is very helpful. Currently, the place where I find it really useful is a patient that says to me, you know what, whenever I come here, it's so different than what it is at home. And I'm like, hey, check out these, you know, check out, like, for example, currently I'm using ProudP. I give them a handout on it. They download the app and then we go over their flows and we go over it either via, you know, a phone call or in the office. And we look at the patterns and we look at, hey, this is your voided volume. This is the number of times you peed in a day. It really does help with the conversation.
So maybe just sort of rounding out the discussion regarding sort of diagnostics, where does urodynamics fit in? And what are the scenarios where you sort of say to yourself, hey, this patient really needs some type of urodynamics or more formal assessment? And if you do urodynamics, do you always do that in conjunction with, say, a cystoscopy? Like, talk about this sort of, maybe not the bread and butter index patient who responds right away from medication, but how do you incorporate urodynamics and any type of cystoscopy into your algorithm?
So for patients where we're looking at, let's say, supplements, we're looking at medication, those patients, I typically don't get a urodynamics, right? I typically reserve urodynamics and I ask the question, what question am I trying to answer here, right? In other words, am I trying to figure out, do you have, let's say, overactive bladder versus bladder outlet obstruction versus pelvic floor dysfunction? I'll use urodynamics there, right? The other place where I find urodynamics, and I think even the, we have right now Eurocuff, the penile cuff test, that's also very helpful in determining bladder outlet obstruction. So for me, there'll be some patients that come in and they desire a certain treatment. Like, for example, they really want to resume, right? But they're like, can you tell me with the resume, how long am I going to have the catheter? I go, well, you know, depends on the number of sticks, depends on how strong your bladder is, right? There's one variable I can control, which is the number of sticks, but I can't control how strong your bladder is. Mm-hmm. And for some patients, having that information of the bladder contractility really does help assess sort of like, are you a good candidate for these tissue altering procedures, or do you really just need a cavitating procedure, right? So I use urodynamics when there's a fork in the road, and we need more information to move that patient forward. So do I need to know more about like your urgency, frequency, nocturia, is that related to outlet obstruction? Is that overactive bladder? Is there another something else going on? Do I need a bladder diary? Or is it along the lines of like how strong your bladder is? And can we consider something like a tissue altering procedure versus doing a cavitating procedure?
And maybe just the last question, which sort of dovetails with this a little bit, but it's a little tangential, is can you talk just briefly about how you think about these patients that come in with obstructive and irritative symptoms? And in your mind, do you first try to say, look, I'm going to tackle the obstructive symptoms because we can use something like an alpha blocker, and then look at the resultant impact on the obstructive, and then revisit the irritative to see what is residual? Like, how do you sort of address these male patients with lower urinary tract symptoms who may have both an obstructive and an irritative component? And does urodynamics play in the initial evaluation prior to therapy?
So Jay, I think that's a great question, because first thing is that what I try to do is one of the first questions I ask patients is, what is a symptom that's bothering you the most, right? So in other words, and sometimes they'll say something like, look, I pee all the time, right? So they're already pointing you in the fact that it's really the irritative component, right? And then I also ask them, like, what is your goal? What are you looking to do here, right? And some patients will go, look, I just want to make sure I don't have cancer, right? And it's like, okay, great. We'll get a couple of tests. We'll check a PSA, digital rectal exam, and then those patients are sort of where they want to be, right? Assuming we're not missing anything. Other patients, when they go like, look, I'm just, you know, I can't go anywhere. I can't go to the movies. I can't go anywhere else, right? Then I'll ask them, like, look, we can try some pills. Based on what you're telling me, you know, your PVR is really low. It sounds like you've got it sounds more like overactive bladder to me, more of a bladder issue versus a prostate issue. So we'll try, we'll go down the overactive bladder pathway. And if at some point we kind of go, we need more information, we'll do that. But if patients kind of go, hey, like, I've got both obstructive symptoms, irritative symptoms, my go-to is to try an alpha blocker first. I mean, for a lot of men, and I think more commonly, it is related to obstruction that's leading to both irritative and obstructive symptoms. So I'll try an alpha blocker first. Now, if the alpha blocker gives them no improvement or very minor improvement, at that point, I'll stop the medicine and kind of try a beta-3 agonist. We'll try that next. Or we'll even try like a PDE5 inhibitor, right? But I'll also ask the patient, like, you know, look, we're doing educated decision-making as we go along. We have some flows to guide us. We've got your IPSS to guide us. But sometimes we just need more information. Like, for example, you had brought up the point of cystoscopy. So for every patient that's going to get surgical intervention, I do cystoscopies on every single one, because I want to know exactly what I'm up against. And I want to show the patient, like, look, here's your ball valve median lobe. This is the exact reason why I can't offer you an iTind. Or if we do a resume, you may have a catheter for a longer period of time, right? Looking inside the bladder, I show them, like, hey, this is where the narrowing is. This is the bladder neck. This is the ejaculatory structures. So this way patients understand what anatomy we're working with, and they understand why we're choosing a certain procedure over the other.
So we've talked a lot about sort of diagnostics, decision-making, sort of the basic philosophy of how you look at address these patients. I want to spend maybe the second part of this podcast talking a little bit about maybe some of the new kids on the block with regards to therapy, and not necessarily, you know, what has been in practice for longer periods of time, whether it be monopolar, bipolar TUR, HOLEP, which has obviously gained a lot of traction, green light PVP, so on and so forth. But maybe let's talk about maybe some of the technologies and techniques that are really moving into our treatment paradigm, but maybe folks are less familiar with. So let's start with maybe, you mentioned it, you mentioned iTind and prostatic urethral stents. Talk a little bit about that. How do you evaluate who's appropriate for this? What are the indications, and maybe who shouldn't maybe in your practice get this sort of therapy?
Yeah. So when it comes to the novel therapies, I think, you know, iTind is probably the newest therapy that's FDA approved. We do have a handful of prostatic stents that are in clinical trials. We've got, I would list them off, but I don't want to, because I don't want to leave someone off. Right. But there's a handful of prostatic stents out there. And I think what's really neat about these, iTind's the first of them, is that they are starting the discussion of almost reversible therapy. Right. So in other words, it's the idea of, you know, the way we try alpha blockers. Hey, try this, you know, stent versus a pill, right? And let's see how you do. And if you're happy with it, great. If you're not happy with it, I'll take it out. Now, when it comes to all the prosthetic stents, including iTend, what we are seeing is that they don't work well for middle lobes, right? So if you've got a middle lobe or a high bladder neck, these therapies don't seem to, for high bladder neck, let me leave that one out. But for the prosthetic stents, high bladder neck doesn't work that well. But iTind does address the high bladder neck, does not address middle lobe.
Right? Okay.
And iTind's clinical data is for prostates between 25 grams and 75 grams. So I would say, like, when patients come in, a lot of them are interested in a therapy where, look, I have the option of not delivering any energy to the prostate, one, no permanent foreign body, two, and then three, if you really don't like it, I can take it out and you haven't closed the door to any other therapy, right? So I think iTind really does lower that bar of sort of getting patients into definitive treatment and getting them off medication. Now, there's a bunch of caveats. We know that when you talk about iTind, the data for it, you know, we published the multi-center study in the US. We had 1 year of data, right? If you look at the total iTind data that we're sort of like using to counsel patients, it's around 250 to 270 patients right now, right? Of patients who are followed. And I would say there's a subset, maybe around 50 to 100 patients that have data out to like 2 or 3 years. So we don't have that robust data that UroLift has, Rezūm has. But I do think for a lot of men who are sort of on that fence of, look, I don't like the side effects of medications. I want a therapy that could be definitive. I think iTind is that potential, right? And I think what's neat about iTind also is that it's the only therapy that we have right now that really addresses the bladder neck, except for obviously, you know, procedures that you had mentioned, like HoLEP, TURP, GreenLight, like those address the bladder neck. But the minimally invasive therapies, this is the first one that addresses the bladder neck.
And then maybe just going a little further with iTind, and we'll just talk about iTind because, as you mentioned, it's sort of the only one that's really out in the space right now with all with others in the pipeline. But with regards to iTind, is this do you put it under, just for my own education, this is put in under local in the office? It's a procedure like a outpatient or operative type procedure. And then the second part of that is, at what point do you expect or do you assess for symptom improvement? And is that like sort of symptomatic improvement, or is that objective, like flow rate? Like, how do you follow these folks afterwards to know whether it's achieving the effect you're hoping for?
Yeah. So when it comes to iTind, it's a two-step procedure, right? So step number one can be done in the office with a flexible scope under local anesthetic. It can also be done with a rigid scope. But when I do it with a rigid scope, I typically have sedation on board. You deploy a crimped iTind through the scope, and you actually park it right into the right behind the bladder neck. It's got three cutting struts, one at 12 o'clock, one at 5 o'clock, one at 7 o'clock. And it's got like a tongue that holds it right behind the bladder neck. The device stays in for about 5 to 7 days. I usually keep it in for 7 days. And then following that, the device is then removed in the office through a basically a Foley catheter with a tip cut off. And you basically re-crimp it into that and remove the device. I would say that, you know, during the 5 to 7 days, you know, patients can have some discomfort because obviously you're having ischemic necrosis occurring at these locations. Following this, you know, they do get a pretty good relief of symptoms once the device is removed. But I do tell patients, like, just like when it comes to Rezūm, UroLift, TURPs, and green lights, that it's going to take several weeks to sort of get that net benefit. So give yourself, you know, 2-3 weeks and let's see how you feel. And then I also say that, you know, we're going to do an assessment roughly at the 3 month mark. If at 3 months, you haven't achieved what you're looking to achieve, at that point, we start having a discussion in terms of, you know, what else we're going to do. Mm-hmm. I do follow these patients with Uroflows, post-void residuals, and IPSS.
Okay. So, and maybe one last question to this is that, let's say you have a patient that you used iTind and you're going to come back 6-12 months down the road and you're considering a repeat intervention. Is this somebody that you would rescope? Before, is your general policy, do you rescope folks before you move on to subsequent surgical procedures? Is that like a general tenet that you would recommend following?
Yeah. So if you look at the AUA guidelines, when it comes to patients who've had previous interventions, I typically would do a repeat cystoscopy. I would also do a urodynamics. And the reason being is that if this patient failed the therapy, I want to know why, right? Did they have underlying detrusor underactivity that we didn't discover on the initial treatment? Did they have overactivity? Sort of what is the it that we're dealing with? So I do get both assessments prior to moving patients forward.
Got it. Maybe let's talk about some of the other new missed therapies. And I'll throw two out to you, but you're more than welcome to sort of comment on some of the others. But maybe Aquablation and Optilume. Maybe talk a little bit about each of those and sort of the same story that we had with iTind. Who, maybe a little bit on how you do it, when you expect the effect, who you shouldn't or who you don't recommend doing it in, and then obviously any others that I'm not obviously covering or asking you about.
Yeah. So I would say let's start with Aquablation because that's another really neat player in the market. And the reason why I think Aquablation is very cool is because it is the first of truly automated surgery, right? So when you think about it, it's the first procedure where you're mapping out prostate on ultrasound. You map it out. And then following that, your foot's on the pedal and you're just watching this tissue get ablated. Now, the Aquablation is obviously blind to bleeding, but it's very, you mapped out where the capsule is, you mapped out where the bladder neck is, you mapped out where Viru is. So it's the first of truly automated procedures. And I think that is very neat. So it reduces that learning curve. And also it can address any prostate anatomy, whether you've got a prostate that's 30 grams or you have a prostate that's 250 grams. And what's equally neat about that is that irrespective of prostate size, that procedure takes roughly around 30 to 45 minutes, right? So it's going to ablate tissue regardless. I think it's great for a variety of prostates. And I think if you were going to have a tool in the armamentarium, that's a tool that is, a pretty good Swiss Army knife because you can address a variety of conditions with it. But it's got limitations. Obviously, bleeding is one of them, but the company has addressed that with a variety of techniques. Most recently, it's focal bladder neck coagulation, where you're going out to the bladder neck and you are basically resecting a very thin layer of tissue and you're doing pinpoint cautery at those bleeding vessels. So I think anyone who's on active coagulation, anyone who active anticoagulation, or someone who can't stop anticoagulation for a reasonable amount of time, I would lean them slightly away from Aquablation for that reason. Other than that, I think it works really well. It spares ejaculation probably close to 90% of the time. So it is relatively ejaculatory sparing as well. So I think that's a very neat player in the market. When it comes to Optilume I've used extensively for urethral strictures, and I think it's got really remarkable data in that space. Its initial trials look really good when it comes to, QMAX. You've got really good data there. But I think it's going to be interesting how it fits into the space. So I'm still following it along. I haven't really done it so much for BPH, but I've done a lot more for strictures because I'm curious to see how that paclitaxel coated balloon, is it able to coat truly prostatic adenoma versus just the mucosa? So, so the initial data seems like it works really, really well.
And similar to sort of our ITIN discussion, after you have these type of procedures, is it a fairly similar algorithm of follow-up that you use just irrespective of what modality do you use? Do you have a pretty cookie cutter follow-up with regards to symptoms and objective assessments to get a sense of effectiveness of the therapy?
Generally speaking, yes. So in other words, if it's patients that are following a algorithm where they're doing well, it's generally the same. It's going to be an assessment at 6 weeks. Again, same thing, IPSS, Euroflow, PVR, 3 months, 6 months, right? If a patient isn't doing well, I want to see them more frequently, mainly because I want to see what are they not happy with, what's the cause of the symptoms. And sometimes it's kind of funny, but you'll find these patients who, they'll... And during their postoperative period, they're limiting fluid intake, right? And they're like, man, it really burns. And you're like, well, that's what happens if you don't drink more fluid. It's a counterintuitive, but drinking more fluid makes the burning go away. So sometimes you can pick up on certain things, like some patients will develop constipation postoperatively and just be straining more, leading to more bleeding. So I think I see them more often and do more frequent assessments. But I also try to map things out with that patient up front, being like, all right, if at this point you're not doing a lot better, we're going to talk about maybe we'll do a cystoscopy at 3 months. Maybe we'll do further tests at some point to figure out why things aren't going well.
So, maybe my last question for you is, when I went through training, the paradigm was always back then, you go maximum medical therapy, and then after maximum medical therapy, you move on to surgical interventions. And now, probably in the last 5-10 years, particularly the last 5 years, we're seeing this revolution or evolution, maybe is the better word, where we have all of these less invasive surgical options that are becoming available, missed therapies, office-based. So I guess my question for you is, are you starting to notice in your practice that it maybe isn't this cascade of medical therapy, fail medical therapy, go to surgical therapy, but are there some patients now who are looking at some of these missed therapies as an opportunity to maybe not take another medication or to maybe address a disease and avoid side effects of medical therapy or the chronicity of medical therapy? Maybe just sort of your comments on that.
Yeah. So, Jay, I think you're right. The paradigm has shifted dramatically. We're seeing more patients who are aware of polypharmacy. They're more aware of the fact that I don't want to start another pill that's for a lifetime. So a lot of patients will come in seeking a therapy that sort of like sings to them, like, hey, I really like this therapy because I don't want to change my ejaculation. I want something that's, safe, effective. It's got good long-term outcomes. So I think the paradigm has shifted dramatically where, at that first visit, you are telling the patient, look, there's medical options, there's surgical options, and there's a handful of surgical options. And among the surgical options, like, there's not one therapy that's better than the rest. They all have sort of risk benefits, right? Mm-hmm. And the initial assessment with a cystoscopy, a transrectal ultrasound, really does help guide that discussion in terms of like, are we going to get you into the minimally invasive therapy where we're talking about things like UroLift, Rezūm, iTind, or are you someone that we're going to be talking about like, larger prostates where you might be getting Aquablation, GreenLight, TERP. So I do think that that initial assessment and figuring out what the patient is looking for in terms of goals really does move that discussion.
No, that makes sense. That's great. Well, Bilal, I really want to thank you. I always like doing some podcasts in areas that I don't do as much at all in clinical practice, because I feel like I learn a lot. And I think you did a great job both for myself, but I certainly would say for our audience of, I think, distilling down a lot of the practical aspects of how to evaluate men with BPH and introducing many of us to some of the new therapies and the new kids on the block. So I do want to really thank you for both your time and as well as your expertise.
Thanks, Jay.
For our audience, we thank you very much for your attention. For more information, please visit us at auanet.org/university. Bilal, I hope to see you soon, maybe in about 6-8 weeks at the annual meeting, hopefully.
Looking forward to it.